Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you for being here. What we're going to do first is carry on from our public hearing yesterday. Yesterday, we had Senate Bill 385 up. We were not able to get all of the testimony in, and I have a list of those who are still here on the list from yesterday that are we are going to hear from if they were able to get back here today. So I'll go ahead and open up a continuation of a public hearing on Senate Bill 385. And I'm going to go ahead and ask Troy Costellas to please come forward first. I know you have another appointment that you need to move to. And Troy, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Troy Costellas. I am the administrator for the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I am here this morning testifying in opposition of Senate Bill 385. The department has significant safety concerns in relationship to what happens if this bill was to become law. An item I'd like to point out, yesterday's testimony, there were some diagrams and some pictures that were shown. And also reference to the Team Oregon Motorcycle Safety Training Program. Lane splitting or filtering is not taught in the Team Oregon program, but emergency space management and using the space between cars if there was an emergency is part of what is taught in the curriculum. And that is one of the concerns, is that by motorcyclists now being on that white line between the vehicles, what happens is you pinch in the area and you could take away any of the emergency space should something like that happen and where a motorcyclist needs to react. And what I'd like to do is share with you some of the data that we pulled as best as we can replicate the situation related to rear-end collisions involving motorcyclists. We took a look out over the last 3 years, and there were just under 33,100 motorcycle crashes in the state during that three-year time period. Those involved where there was a fatality, those that were involved as an injury, and those that were involved where there was property damage only to the vehicles or property around the roadside. We then took a look, because this bill deals with, and there's some testimony in OLIS that was presented to you talking about a motorcyclist being rear-ended with frequency, resulting in death or injury. And so we took those situations of the fatal, the injury, and the property damage, and showed then how often is it where it's a rear-end collision between the vehicles in the traffic stream. And then from underneath that, looked specifically at the motorcycle and to determine whether the motorcyclist was being struck or whether the motorcyclist was doing the striking in those rear-end situations. And you can see across that bit, the bulk of the majority of the time when there's a rear-end crash involving a motorcycle, the motorcyclist is the striking vehicle. The one case on the far left where in the last 3 years where it was a motorcyclist that was struck was a case of May 2014 in the Happy Valley area where an individual driving an SUV attempted to pass two motorcyclists and hit one of the two motorcyclists, unfortunately killed that individual on the motorcycle. That individual was indicted and then later pled guilty to criminally negligent homicide and DUI under the influence of drugs. So it was not a situation that this bill deals with in relationship to stop-and-go traffic. This was on an open road type scenario. These are all roads of all types, and this bill is addressing only those roads that are 50 miles an hour or higher related to the potential posted speed. So out of the 12 fatal, three of those were on multi-lane state highways, 94 of the injury crashes on the multi-lane state highways, and 25 of the property damage. And then the strike versus struck percentages are even higher, to where the motorcyclist is the striking vehicle in those particular situations. Share that data with you, and also shared that with the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety and the proponents of the bill, just to say, we look at the crash data, here's what comes out of an evaluation as best as we can replicate what the scenario is that Senate Bill 385 talks about. There's also some of the written testimony presented to you refers to the Berkeley study related to California. And what I'd like to share with you is that in California, there were 6,000 crashes that were evaluated, and just under 1,000 of them were related to the lane splitting scenario that was in the study. 17% of the crash data that was presented through California Highway Patrol related to lane splitting. That 17% of crashes we don't experience in Oregon because we do not have lane splitting. And that's part of the safety concern, is that by introducing lane splitting, you have the potential of seeing these numbers go up by 17% because we don't have the condition of lane splitting in Oregon like they do in California. And also in that study, the author says, and I'll quote the author, the lane splitting riders often put themselves closer to other vehicles than they otherwise would. This proximity reduces the time riders have to identify and react to changes in the behavior of the motorists around them. And that's part also in addition to our safety concerns. And then closing, Mr. Chair, the other is that there are some other conflicts in statute that this bill brings up, which is submitted in ODOT's written testimony. The public opinion in Oregon the last 2 years, because this bill was in front of the legislative body last session, we included in our statewide survey a question about individuals if they felt that lane splitting would be something that they, you know, what their feelings were about it. And 82% of those all across the state, in all areas of the state, 82% did not support this potential change in law. Mr. Chair, it also lastly, the law enforcement was mentioned in testimony yesterday. Law enforcement goes through constant training for those that are motor officers. They do not allow their personnel to go between the lanes. Even in emergency situations, they will call ahead. Going in between lanes of cars for officers is in a dire emergency where they're under threat, but they're also a situation where they're under constant training. So in close, Mr. Chair, Department of Transportation is testifying in opposition of 385, and appreciate the opportunity to come back this morning, knowing that yesterday's time limits caught up to everybody related to the amount of testimony.
All right. Any questions for Troy? Thank you very much, and thank you for presenting that PowerPoint. And I understand from looking here, it looks like it has been posted at least the one slide. Is it possible to the breakout slides that you kind of walked us through? I guess this is the accumulation of it, I assume.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
We'll just go with that.
The reason we laid it out so you understand the layers, because otherwise it's not real intuitive.
All right. If there's no questions, Troy, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and ask Joe Elliott and Bob Russell and Marie Dodd to come up next.
I've received written testimony from Bob Russell.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you all very much for being here. Whoever would like to start off, if you could give us your name first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marie Dodds. I represent AAA Oregon, and I'm here to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 385 today. In congested road conditions, it's human nature for motorists to try to seek openings in adjacent lanes in hopes that lane will move more quickly than the one they are in. When drivers change lanes, their focus is on quickly taking advantage of temporary gaps in the flow of traffic. It would be far too easy for motorists to miss motorcycles that would be darting into that open space if lane splitting were legalized. The result is that motorists will likely move right into the path of motorcycles engaged in lane splitting. Because this legislature is moving forward legislation that makes motorcycles a vulnerable driver, lane splitting exposes motorists to criminal penalties when they take actions that today are completely legal, such as changing lanes in congested traffic. Today, motorcycles do not make that a risky proposition. Senate Bill 385 would. Arguments that lane splitting is necessary to prevent rear-end collisions between cars and motorcycles are simply not supported by the statistics. You just heard Mr. Costales go over those numbers, so I won't repeat them here today. The emergence of new technologies combined with the broad array of existing distractions make drivers less aware of their surroundings. Our own AAA studies show that drivers suffer from severe cognitive impairment when engaged in various tasks while driving, even when using completely legal hands-free devices such as their smartphones and their vehicle infotainment systems. Though this legislature is taking steps to toughen Oregon's distracted driving laws, those efforts will not eliminate this problem. Expecting drivers to take on additional and historically unanticipated awareness responsibilities while driving is a recipe for disaster. Given the combination of motorists not being aware of lane splitting, the increase in distracted driving, and the increased likelihood of driving errors resulting from congestion-based driver behavior, it is highly likely that the fatality and injury count would increase rather than decrease should lane splitting become a legal practice in Oregon. In fact, AAA is concerned about this practice nationwide and opposes the legalization of lane splitting. AAA also supports imposing restrictions or banning the practice where it's currently legal because of all of these safety concerns. In a contest between cars and motorcycles on the road, the motorcycle loses and nobody wins. Thank you again for letting me speak today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
All right. We'll go ahead and take Joe's testimony first. And, Joe, thank you very much. I understand you had to make arrangements to stay over since we didn't get through, and I apologize that we weren't able to get to you yesterday.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, and I do appreciate to be able to testify today. Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and good morning, committee members. This is my first time testifying in a hearing such as this, so if I'm please advise me of any protocol should I misstep.
You're going to do great. As soon as you give us your name, you can do whatever you want.
Okay. My name is Joe Elliott, and I'm from Springfield, Oregon, and I'm here representing the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. That's a committee of 8 volunteered citizens that compromise that that make up that committee, and we advise the governor and the governor's highway safety representative on motorcycle issues and on public roadways in Oregon. I'm a motorcyclist and a scientist, and after graduate school in nuclear physics at OSU, I got a chance to go down for a couple decades in Southern California, and there I was a motorcycle trainer. I was recognized by the California Highway Patrol as Instructor of the Year, and I happen to also own and operate the busiest motorcycle training facility in the United States at that time. I have a lot of experience in lane sharing and lane filtering, lane splitting. Back then, we called it white lining, and I did it at all different speeds, all different roads, on many different motorcycles. Over the years, the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety has debated and heard and thought about lane sharing in Oregon and on Oregon roads. Recently, in our February meeting, they heard testimony on the merits of lane sharing and on the problems of lane sharing. And after that meeting, or during that meeting, they decided to oppose SB 385. The main points: law enforcement said it was unenforceable, and the speed and lane sharing is unenforceable. My experience is that's exactly right. This speed is, there's no way to enforce that. Motorcycle experts from Team Oregon talked about, as Mr. Costala said, you know, the space cushion around you as well as escape routes. When you're a motorcyclist and you're approaching the cars and you go between them, now there's 3 uncomfortable drivers, the 2 car drivers, and then me, the motorcyclist. We're in a tight space. We're going to accelerate through that. We're going to speed through that. We overtake uninvited into their space, and then we want to get out of that space. We're always traveling faster than other traffic. I won't go over the data on that ODOT just presented. In the meeting, they presented the 2015 data, 61 total fatalities in all of Oregon, 0 from being struck from the rear for motorcyclists. So other road rage users, you just heard from AAA, we heard from them as well. The Oregon Trucking Association, other users do not want this bill. So as a result, we voted 5-2 to oppose SB 385. And we feel opposition to this bill supports motorcyclists and all road rage users in Oregon. That's my testimony for the Governor's Advisory Committee. I'd like to continue just with a few comments on lane sharing as an expert on lane sharing and just a scientist who studied.
And just for the record, we'll give you a little disclaimer here. You're now speaking on behalf of yourself and not on behalf of the committee?
Yes.
Advisory committee?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that very much. Motorcycles are fast. A slow motorcycle is like a fast car, and fast motorcycles are much faster. So when you're in a tight situation, you're going to roll on the gas and get out of the way. It's going to be very difficult to maintain your speed at the suggested speed limits. I had a motorcycle that went from 0 to 60 in 2.3 seconds. And when I take it to the drag strip, it could go up in the at a quarter mile in 11 to 12 seconds. They're very powerful. And you're going to use that if you're on a motorcycle to get out of tight spots. When you look at the lanes of traffic, like this bill suggests, they're not just perfectly stacked up. They're variegated. And you're going to be going through, and some cars will move out of the way. In California, we give them have a little clubby thing. We'd wave to them, and some don't. And some spots get really tight. You'll click mirrors sometimes. Your mirrors will click their mirrors in this type of bill that's addressing. So congestion, L.A. has congestion. There's big congestion there. And the solution to congestion is better engineered roads being built. There's 200 other vehicles for every one motorcycle. So the suggestion mathematically will be very difficult to suggest that moving the motorcycle around in the space, one vehicle per 200, would have much effect on congestion. I would question that. So, and thank you for your time and a little extra you gave me, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Joe and Marie? Thank you all very much for coming forward. As stated, it appears that Bob Russell has given us written testimony, which is posted. So this will bring us to Christopher Slater. Christopher?
Good morning. Thank you for having me back. I need to begin by a question for the chair. Is it Przanski, Przanski, or Przanski? Because I heard all three yesterday.
Yeah, that's true. And at home, I heard Przanski and Przanski, depending on if it was mom or dad. So,
what do you prefer?
Just don't call me late for dinner.
And don't call me Christian with my last name. That happens with frequency. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Christopher Slater. I'm a motorcycle accident attorney. I'm licensed to practice law in the state of Oregon and Washington. I've been practicing for 20 years. Started riding motorcycles in 1985. We were here 2 years ago on a very similar bill. In fact, I think I can say the same bill. We had a Dash 1 amendment. A lot of thought and care has gone into this bill to try and, as narrowly as possible, tailor it so that we get the safety benefits out of filtering without leading to some of the lane-splitting techniques that are seen in California, which can be found on YouTube, where you have high-speed motorcycles filtering, or splitting, I should say, at speeds which are greater than the speed differential I would recommend, which is 10 miles per hour. It was 2 years ago I was here testifying on Senate Bill 694, although it seems like I was here yesterday. I guess I was here yesterday. Traffic, as you heard yesterday, has gone from number 10 to number 8. So traffic has gotten worse. The data that supports the safety benefits of lane splitting has actually improved. Between the report that came out in 2014 and 2015, the data has actually gotten better. And California is no longer this sort of Wild West. Well, it's not permitted, it's not prohibited. They passed a law, AB 51, last year, formally recognizing the legality of lane splitting and having the California Highway Patrol promulgate guidelines on the safe practices of lane splitting. We have some new faces, so I'll be repeating some things I said last session, and I'll try to be brief. I know you have some bills behind us here. My concern as a motorcycle accident attorney is that the Oregon Vehicle Code treats motorcycles as if they were cars, which they are not. Motorcycles have different safety features from cars. The safety features of motorcycles are smaller size, greater acceleration, greater braking, and greater maneuverability. Once a motorcycle is involved in an accident, there really are no safety features. It comes down to the rider's gear choices. By treating motorcycles as cars, the Oregon Vehicle Code is not taking advantage of the safety benefits of that a motorcycle has to offer. And the parallel I'd point you to is bicycles, because 20 years ago, bicycles were treated like cars. But in Portland and Eugene, they're treated much differently now. And I think there's been safety benefits as a result of that. Just to touch briefly on the legal issues, I am not a criminal defense attorney. There is testimony from a former Klamath County Sheriff, Tim Evinger, that's in the record, and I would point you to that regarding any enforcement issues or concerns that the committee may have. Regarding the liability issues that may be raised, I would say as a civil practitioner, there are no changes in terms of liability. All vehicle operators owe a duty of reasonable care to each other. This bill does not change that. And in fact, by placing motorcycles in between the lanes, you're removing motorcycles from the blind spot, because that's in the lane next to the car, and placing them squarely in the view of the side mirror of a car operator. Everyone that's come here and testified in support of the bill and in opposition to the bill, I think, are good-natured people that have the safety concerns of all Oregonians at heart. We are not asking car drivers to do anything differently than they should be doing already, which is, before changing lanes, please check your side mirror, use your turn signal. As a rider, I'm watching. We're not looking at a cell phone or a navigation system. We're watching the road. We're watching cars. If I see a turn signal in front of me, I'm going to slow down and wave, literally gesture the car to move, because I don't want to place myself in a situation where a car is going to change lanes in my path. A word about the data. I have tremendous respect for Troy Costales, a statistician for ODOT. He presented, I think, a great chart which shows frequency. I do have a word of caution regarding strike versus struck. As a motorcycle accident attorney, I can tell you, in the overwhelming majority of cases that I have, the motorcycle is the striking vehicle. And that's because cars make left turns in front of a motorcycle, and the motorcycle strikes the car. A car pulls out of a driveway or into a side street in front of the motorcycle's path without looking or seeing the motorcycle, and the motorcycle strikes the car. So when it comes to strike versus struck, it does not surprise me that we have a large amount of strikes versus strucks in all accident situations, because largely primary issue that I see as a motorcycle accident attorney is that vehicle operators are not seeing motorcycles. I did want to point to something that is in ODOT's testimony, just because we heard testimony from Dr. Layshock yesterday regarding the UC Berkeley California Highway Patrol study, and that's that there are some studies cited by ODOT to support the proposition that lane filtering is up to 390% more likely to create accidents, and the studies weren't referenced or cited in the submission, but if you look at the end, there's some studies that are referenced. These are three studies from the city of Marseille, France, and they are urban filtering, meaning city streets where there's pedestrian traffic, all kinds of traffic, and actually, I've been to France. They ride in the bus lanes in France. And so I'm not sure how the data that's being positioned by ODOT regarding filtering in urban congested traffic city street situations applies to the parameters of this bill. And with respect to the percentage of motorcycles, I want to be clear. You heard testimony yesterday that if 10% of all motorcycle drivers got in motorcycles unfiltered, the delay times for all vehicle operators would be reduced by 40%. Vehicle registrations in the state of Oregon constitute 4%. It's not 1 in 200. It's 1 in approximately 20. So we're clear, we're not proposing that we will see the type of congestion relief benefits in the Belgian study. I think there will be some benefits. We have people leaving their motorcycles at home and taking their cars because there's no benefit to taking the motorcycle. My concern is not the number of accidents. I mean, and I know that sounds strange. It's the human outcomes from the accidents that do occur. And as a motorcycle accident attorney, I'm in somewhat of a unique position. You heard testimony from a former first responder trainer yesterday who talked about outcomes. And I want to talk to you a little bit about outcomes, because ODOT tracks fatalities, and I think we all agree we don't want any fatalities. But what ODOT does not track is the severity of injuries that result from different types of collisions. So I want to show you just briefly a video that demonstrates the severity of collisions. Sorry, it's looping for some reason. So in my practice as a motorcycle accident attorney, I see similar outcomes as we heard from the first responder trainer yesterday. I see in rear end accidents, I see orthopedic fractures, joint injuries, traumatic brain injuries, internal injuries. And from the glancing type of impacts we see in where there's not a direct perpendicular strike between the motorcycle and another vehicle, and those can be serious. And I see those in my practice, typically left turn oncoming. The glancing type impacts typically result in soft tissue injuries. There may be some exceptions, obviously, especially if there's any kind of helmet contact to the pavement. But the types of injuries that I think that we can see in lane filtering that would occur under this bill are markedly less significant than the type of injuries that we're trying to prevent that were demonstrated in the video. And the data is borne out in the UC Berkeley study, which studied 6,000 motorcycle accidents. And when they looked at the lane splitting accidents, and this data was presented to you yesterday by Dr. Layshock, we see as a group all lane splitting, which includes high-speed lane splitting that happens down in California, all kinds, all lane splitting, 60% fewer fatalities, 46% fewer head injuries, 34% fewer torso injuries, 17% fewer neck injuries, and 10% fewer upper and lower extremity injuries. In the 2014 study...
Christopher, I'm going to need you to start.
And I'm going to wrap up. Thank you very much. In the 2014 study, there's data that is actually broken out that applies to the parameters of this bill. It looks at under 25 mile per hour travel by the motorcycle with a speed differential of 10 miles per hour or less. I'll point out that ours is 20 with a differential of 10 or less. And there were zero fatalities out of 1,000 approximately lane splitting accidents that were studied in California. Zero. And the further reduction in injuries are noted in my written submission. So just to wrap it up, as a motorcycle accident attorney, it's my opinion that accidents will happen regardless of what rules are put in place for road users. But by focusing on the safety benefit, the features of different vehicles, policy can be crafted that will reduce the gravity of resulting injuries from accidents that do occur by implementing the rules that take advantage of the unique safety features of motorcycles. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Chris, I have a couple for you, or Christopher, I have a couple for you. First of all, just for the record, you made a comment that bicycles are different under the code, meaning the vehicle code. They're not. They are a vehicle. That's how they're identified. I assume your statements are that we as a society is recognized putting in dedicated lanes and stuff like that.
And if I may, they're actually, bicycles are on the vulnerable users list, so they're in subject drivers that are negligent or careless in causing an accident to bicyclists are subject to enhanced criminal penalties. They're also currently covered by the vehicular assault statute. Motorcyclists and their passengers are not.
Right. So let me ask you, on your handout that you had yesterday, you have three examples at the on the bottom of different people that were involved in different type of accidents.
All clients.
So the last two, and I know Jessica Naylor testified yesterday, those two just don't seem to be applicable to the situation we're talking about. Both of those look like they were urban, and it looks like they were on basically city streets as compared to being on a highway that's got at least a minimum of 50 miles an hour.
And that is correct, and I certainly did not, I hope I did not give the impression that I was representing otherwise.
All right, and then the other thing is, under this concept, Mr. Givens seemed to be the only one of the three that we close to being in this setting of being applicable. But he was on the off-ramp. I would assume that the off-ramp speed was less than 50 miles an hour. And so my questions are two. Would this apply to if you have a backup in the congestion on off-ramp that the motorcyclist would be able to pass on either the left or the right to go beyond and get in front?
It would not. And in California, there are ramps that have signs that say motorcycles okay, so you don't have to wait to filter on the ramp. I would call this a baby step in the direction of the policy changes that I was talking about. So ramps, because they're not speed limits are much lower, would not be subject to the statute.
And just for the record, the same would be for in these high congested areas where there are metered on ramps. This would not, this bill under your concept would not allow for them to jump to the front.
The only circumstances in which a motorcycle would be able to filter under the parameters of this bill is on a Salem Parkway is, I think, a good example. Posted speed limit is 50 or 55 in different sections, and there are lights. So in those situations, they would be allowed to filter, but not on any streets that have lower speed limits.
All right. Any other questions? Christopher, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being able to come back today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. This hearing was continued from yesterday for the five individuals that were signed up yesterday. So we'll close that public hearing, and we're now going to go into our hearings that are scheduled for today. What I'm going to do is open up a public hearing on all three of the bills since they have variations, and I believe the testimony of those who have signed up may have people wanting to sign up, and we're going to, yeah, we'll start with Senator Riley, but I just want to look and see who else we've got here. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and open them up just to, for convenience, and if people want to give testimony on all of these, they can do so at one time, not have to come back and forth. So we're opening up public hearings on Senate Bill 117, Senate Bill 133, and Senate Bill 488. Whitney, give us the overview, please, for each of those. And Senator Riley, if you'll come off and lead off, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'll start with Senate Bill 488 because it's the most different from the other two. Senate Bill 488 in its current form is really just a placeholder bill, so we're really looking at the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the bill and removes the emergency clause provision. It addresses issues surrounding fees associated with the recovery of stolen vehicles. It requires law enforcement to provide contact information for the vehicle owner to the tower so that the tower within 24 hours can notify the owner of the vehicle's recovery. It also allows the registered owner of a vehicle totaled after theft to surrender the title to the tower in lieu of payment of the towing fees. Finally, the Dash 1 amendment prohibits a tower from bringing an action against the owner to collect fees associated with these types of tows after the tower has already foreclosed on a lien on the vehicle. There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on that. We also then have Senate Bill 117 and Senate Bill 133. Senate Bill 117 was brought to us by Senator Riley. Senate Bill 117 has a -3 amendment, and Senate Bill 133 has a -2 amendment. Essentially, with those, if you read the bills with those amendments, the two bills are fairly similar. The main difference was with Senator Riley's bill and Senate Bill 117. It would prohibit towers from monitoring parking facilities within 1,000 feet for business and would also create the right to an expedited civil review in circuit court on the validity of a tow. So those two provisions are not in Senate Bill 133. The provisions that do mirror each other is that there's have several stylistic and technical changes. There is also a prohibition added in both bills for a tower from towing a motor vehicle from a parking facility unless there is a sign in plain view restricting parking at the facility. With the amendments, both bills would require that a tower received signed written authorization from the parking facility's owner or agent prior to a tow, and it would also prohibit the tower from acting as the owner's agent for purposes of this authorization. Both bills with the amendments would also require that when a tower has multiple storage facilities, that they tow the vehicle to the storage facility that's closest to and within the same county that the vehicle was located in when the tow was conducted. We also have a -1 amendment on Senate Bill 117 that was brought to us by Senator Riley. The provisions in the -1 amendment are not in Senate Bill 133. The -1 amendment would require towers to maintain a copy of the signed authorization mentioned earlier for 2 years and that the authorization be dated. It also requires the parking owner or agent to contact the tower to initiate a tow. So how the law currently reads in Senate Bill 133 also is that the tower can contact the parking owner or owner's agent to initiate the tow, and with the -1 amendment in 117, the owner or agent must contact the tower, not vice versa. There are also two more provisions that are in 117 with the -1 amendment that are not in 133, and what that is there are exceptions to the rules requiring signed authorization to initiate the tow, and it removes two of those exceptions, one in Senate Bill 117 for when there is a sign prohibiting parking 24 hours a day, and in the -1 amendment for certain instances when a person is parked without permission in a residential parking lot. And I think that covers everything.
Thank you very much. So, Chuck, I guess you don't need to testify now.
No, I can go.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony as to the various bills, and we'll do questions right after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chuck Riley, Senator from Senate District 15, Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, North Plains, Roy Verbort, and a lot of farms. And Senate Bill 117 is the current version of my attempt at fixing this problem. I've been working on it since about 2007, so trying to get this right. the problem, as you know, is that vehicles are towed sometimes when there's no reason that they should be towed. An example, a woman and her husband are living in an apartment complex. They have an assigned parking space. The husband goes to work, so that parking space is empty now. The woman's mother comes to take her to the hospital because she's going to have a baby, parks in that assigned parking space, and when they come out, the car is gone. This bill would say that the owner of that parking space, and that is the person who's assigned that space, not the facility, because it's the same as your apartment. Someone can't come into your apartment without your permission, even though it's technically owned by that facility. The same applies to the parking space. And this would say that the person who requires a tow must initiate the tow, not the towing company deciding that there should be a tow and initiating that tow. That's the reason for the difference between being called and calling. One of the other things that has happened in the past, when we required them to take a photograph, that happened, we assume. But we don't know, because when people ask to see the photograph, they say we don't have to show it. The law just says we have to take it. So we wanted to make sure that in this bill, it's required to show not only the photograph that you took, but the signed authorization for the tow. Those are the main issues that we want to make sure happen in this bill. There are a few other, as you pointed out, issues here, but those are the ones that I wanted to really highlight. So I won't go into much further unless you have questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Senator Riley? Chuck, thank you very much. Sorry we had to carry over the stuff this morning.
Not a problem. Yesterday. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So our next panel is going to be others that are in the position of supporting these bills or parts of or some of these bills. So Kim Larson, Meredith Thomas, Aaron Knott, and Cheryl Heisler. Why don't all four of you come up together? And this way we'll just get everything on the record at once. And Cheryl, yeah, I was going to say, Cheryl, once you go first, it sounds like y'all have already worked that out.
Sounds good.
And then if you need to be excused, we can just check real quick and then let you stand down.
Chair Pazansky, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice, here today in support of Senate Bill 133. As you've heard, this bill does a number of different things. The last time we really took a good look at the towing statutes was in 2007, and so we decided it was probably time to do an update and a cleanup in this area. Last year, we sat down with the towing community and discussed a few areas that we wanted to take a look at and had some good conversations there. This is a pretty high complaint area for the Department of Justice Consumer Complaint Hotline. And last year there was 131 complaints regarding towing. So we kind of took a look at those and looked at the most sort of problematic areas that might be beneficial, might have a benefit of cleaning up some statutes. So that's what Senate Bill 133 is. As Whitney mentioned, there's a couple of cleanups. First of all, a lot of confusion can arise when there's not clear signage on a parking facility about you can tow here or you can't park here, you can't park there. So this just clarifies that the signage must be in plain view and be in clear and conspicuous language. We think this will help both towers and consumers when there's more clarity about where you can park and when. Secondly, it defines a hookup. There's been a lot of confusion about when exactly a tow truck is hooked up to a car for the purposes of the tow, and certain obligations arise both from the consumer and the tower at that point in time. So we worked with the towers to come up with a better definition of hookup. There's also some clarification about the nearest available storage facility. What we saw some towers doing was hook up a car, and instead of towing it to, say, point A, which was closest, they'd tow it to point B, which was further away. A lot of towers charge per mile, and there didn't seem to be a reason that they would need to tow to that further facility other than charging more. So just clarifying that you tow to the nearest available storage facility. There are county rules that require the towed car to be in the county, so we just put an amendment in there for that clarification. Finally, you did hear about this from Senator Riley. Already required in current statute is that the tower take a photograph of the vehicle that's parked in violation. This just clarifies that a person can ask for that photograph. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
All right, Cheryl, thank you. Any questions for Senator Lethincombe?
Can you explain a little bit, let's see, section 2, subsection 2, a tower is entitled to a lien, et cetera, the tower may retain possession of the vehicle and its contents. Can you provide justification? You know, that it seems like an extraordinary statement to say not only the vehicle but contents.
Chair Przanski, Senator Linthicum, just so we're clear, are you on page 3 of the bill?
It shows up in 117 and 133.
Which bill are you referring to?
I'm looking at 133. That's okay. What her testimony
okay.
was on.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to make sure we got the record straight since we got two of them.
Sure. The same language appears in both, however.
Sure. Chair Brzezinski, Senator Linthicum, I believe that is currently already in statute, and we've just moved it to a different section here for clarity's sake. What can often happen is a tower will tow a vehicle and store it and will rack up fees during that time. This would allow them to put a lien on the vehicle and the possessions within the vehicle. Currently exempted, and this bill doesn't change that, are the lien doesn't attach, I think, to certain possessions such as, you know, your driver's license and that kind of thing that you would need back. So we're not looking to change that here.
Medication, stuff like that, I believe.
Exactly.
Caught in there, too. Any follow-up?
I guess I don't see where it was struck. It's in bold letters. It appears to be an addition. I can review that, or you can provide me with more data.
Yeah, Chair Przanski, Senator Linthicum, I believe on page 2, line 36, it says 98.835 is repealed, but we can get back to you with some more
okay.
Clarification there.
All right. Any other questions for Cheryl? Cheryl, thank you very much. All right, for the other three, however you'd like to present, and Cheryl, you're more than welcome to stay there, but if you'd like to move back, you're fine to do that too, since you won't be presenting, at least I don't think.
Aaron? Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General and Department of Justice here in support of Senate Bill 488 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments. There's, for those of you who were here for our informational hearings last summer, and I think that might actually just be the chair with Senator Thatcher absent today, we had a presentation on this previously. The issue that gives rise to Senate Bill 488 is the experience of crime victims who find themselves the victim of car theft. When I was in a previous life, I was a prosecutor with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I did a stint in a unit that processed a lot of car theft cases, and I'd talk to victims at grand jury, and I sort of noted at the time that they would come in, and one of their biggest concerns was, you know, it's great that you recovered the car, but gosh, I can't get it back because I can't afford to get it out. And so it's helpful to understand sort of the typical fact pattern of what happens to a stolen car. First of all, a significant portion of stolen cars are recovered, but they're not recovered in predictable condition. Some of them are recovered with everything inside, just blocks from where they were stolen on a joyride situation. Some of them are stripped and completely undrivable and totaled, but still considered a recovered stolen vehicle. So at the point that law enforcement locates a stolen vehicle, they'll stay with it as long as they can. But everybody on this committee is familiar with problems with law enforcement staffing levels. And in our research, it suggests that they often can't stay with that vehicle for more than about an hour. So you as a crime victim will get a phone call, and you'll have an hour to get to your vehicle. But of course, you don't have your vehicle. So depending on where it's located and what time of day it's located, getting to your vehicle may be nearly impossible. You may be at work, you may be at school, you may be out of town, you may be sleeping, you just may be unable to reach the vehicle. So at that point, law enforcement calls a tow. And the tow company, once they take possession of the vehicle, we heard in our research on this that the towers may not even know that the vehicle was stolen. It's just a tow. And so they take it into their possession, and that starts the normal accumulation of fees. So those fees kick up immediately. There are fees for hooking it up, fees for towing it, fees for bringing it into the lot and checking it in, and then from that point on, there are storage fees that naturally accumulate. Now, for the tower, the first question will be, how do you get a hold of the owner of the car? And the process that's used now is that the tower will call up the Department of Motor Vehicles and get that information turned around to them. That takes days. During that multi-day period, fees continue to accumulate. Now, that DMV information is not by any means the most recent information. It just reflects the last address at which this car was titled. There's no phone number and no other contemporary information. This is important in Senate Bill 488, and I'll get to that. But so then the vehicle, usually when they call DMV, that begins a lien process. So if the tower ultimate, how they secure their interest in the car is through the filing of the notice of a lien. That process takes 30 days. And during that period of time, at the end of it, a tower can auction off a car if the owner of the car hasn't been able to pay the fees to get it out. During that period of time, fees will continue to accumulate. So what we would find from crime victims is they'd find out that the car had been recovered, sometimes well after the fact. They'd figure out where it was. They'd go to the tow company, and they'd be unable to pay those fees. And so while they're trying to get the money to get the car out, the fees continue to go up and go up and go up. For those of you who are here during the informational overview last summer, we heard testimony from a few individuals who came in and described that they racked up thousands of dollars in fees, greatly exceeding the value of the car in fairly short order, and then could not walk away from the car. This is because the process to sort of perfect and then auction off, as I stated, takes 30 days. And usually during that 30-day period, you will continue to compound fees. So if your car is undrivable, if it's totaled, if you'd like to walk away from it, you know that you're never going to be able to get it out. Under current law, you can't walk away from that vehicle within a 30-day period. There's no way to simply surrender your title. So at the conclusion of that 30-day period, the car will be auctioned off. Now, what is often the case with stolen cars is that the value of the recovered vehicle is beneath the fees that have been applied to store it. So this makes sense. You have an older car, it's stolen, it comes back totaled or undrivable, it takes 30 days to perfect that lien. During that time, it's accruing storage fees. So at the end of it, you as the crime victim may have an outstanding balance to the tower. At that point, the tower's typical redress is to pursue a collections action against you as the crime victim. So to review, your car is stolen, it's totaled, you don't have it, you don't have the money to get it out, it's auctioned off, and at the conclusion of that process, you owe the tower money. The tower then takes you to collections, small claims, some other action, potentially garnishes your wages, definitely has a negative impact on your credit, both of which make it harder for you to obtain another car, because now you don't have the creditworthiness to obtain a vehicle, even if you can get the money together to do so. So for a victim, this is a real downward spiral of negative events, all of which originated from a decision that they did not make, which was for their car to be stolen. Crime victims, of course, are not responsible for their victimization. So, to talk about what 488-1 does to try to address these problems, there are three broad policy proposals embedded in the -1 amendments, and I'll go through each of them in turn. The first one comes back to that moment of the sharing of information. In the fact pattern I provided, recall that the tower receives their information from the Department of Motor Vehicles, that takes several days, and that almost inherently drives certain fees that might otherwise be avoided. Now, there is better information out there. It's in the possession of law enforcement. Whenever a car is reported stolen, that by definition means somebody reported it. At the time that it's reported stolen, that person gave current information about their phone number, where they're staying, how best to reach them, and other collateral information that can help that person be located. Under existing law, any information in the Law Enforcement Database Service, or LEDS, which is where this information would typically be housed. It's where an officer will get to it just in their onboard dashboard when they're checking to see if a car is stolen, cannot be shared. So to enable that information to be provided directly to towers would require a statutory change, which is one of the things that is proposed in 488-1. Now, of course, this information is protected for a reason. It's very sensitive. It's crime victim information. So we've also included a proviso that makes it clear that it can't be used for any other purpose at all except to try to locate the owner of the vehicle. Secondly, the issue of titling. So, as I stated earlier, if a car is totaled, right now, if you want to walk away from that car, it can be very difficult to do so because of the 30-day lien perfection period. Senate Bill 488-1 attempts to simplify this process by stating if you're the victim of a car theft and your car is totaled, it's not drivable, it's considered totaled, you can walk away from it in an expedited way. It attempts to create a process by which you can surrender a title inside of that 30-day period. Now, we've kept this very narrow deliberately. There are two sideboards here. One, you have to be the victim of car theft, and two, the car has to be considered totaled. The reason we elected to go that route is because we did not want to create a situation where a drivable vehicle, you'd have a tower potentially coming in, and I'm not saying that any of the towers you'll hear from today would ever do this, but it's a possibility we wanted to protect against, where they'd call you up and say, you know, you're in for $1,000. Why don't you just give me your title now on a drivable car that is worth more than that, you know, not an auction, but a resale type environment. We didn't want to risk submitting consumers and crime victims to that kind of a tactic, so we made sure we carved that out. So that's provision number two. Provision number three has to do with the remedy of filing a collections action against a crime victim. And again, keeping in mind, crime victims did nothing wrong. Their car wasn't towed for the usual reason that your cars are towed. You parked them in the wrong place, you drove drunk, you committed some sort of a crime. There are a lot of reasons your cars can get towed, but they usually initiate with you as the driver making a bad decision. You ignore a sign, you park somewhere you shouldn't. Crime victims, it's different. Their car is the subject of theft. So that remedy of not only have you auctioned off the car, but now you're going after the crime victim for the fees that they accumulated while you were holding the car in a way that dismantles their credit. We pulled a group together. I should have mentioned that up front. We met with the towers. We met with the Department of Transportation, the insurance industries, crime victims advocates, the DAs, the sheriffs, the law center, all designed to sort of noodle on this. And this last point was one that many of us felt strongly about, that pursuing a small claims remedy against a crime victim because they were unable to pay the fees that they accumulated while you were holding their car, when you've already extracted all of the value of the car through auction, is just not fair to the crime victim. So Senate Bill 488-1 does disallow that remedy for towers. It says you can get the value from the vehicle, but that's as far as you can go. You cannot pursue collections actions for fees that were accumulated beyond that value, and you cannot take actions that will downstream damage the creditworthiness of the victim in a way that makes it harder for them to recover from their victimization. Now, one crucial question we asked there, we know that towers have to make money. That's very clear to us, and we don't want to disrupt their business model. These are not charities. We understand that. So one question we did put out there was, what percentage of tows tend to be stolen? And the only, you know, this isn't tracked in any coherent way that we could find. So the only law enforcement entity that was able to give us a response was the Oregon State Police, because their tracking, particularly on towing matters, is a little bit better and more consistent than what we see in the rest of the state. They reviewed their files and they estimate that fewer than 2% of the tows that they request are stolen. Now, that data is going to be noisy. It'll be higher in some municipalities, but it, had it been 20%, 30%, 50%, I'd be more concerned about the fee that we would be passing on to towers. As it stands, most of these tows come about because you are on a preferential tow list, meaning you're given access to law enforcement and municipal or county tows in a consistent way. This is a small part of that portfolio. And while this bill does represent a certain passing of expense from a crime victim to a tower, we believe that that is a fair reflection of the victimization of the crime victim as balanced against the larger body of business that a tower gets through municipal and county preference contracts. This is a very small part of the total body of tows. And the cases where you auction and go over after an overage are yet smaller still. So we think that these are fair, balanced proposals to try to get at this problem, and we urge your support.
All right, thank you, Aaron. So Meredith and Kim, who'd like to go next? That'd be great, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kim Larson. I'm the Director of Victim Assistance with the Marion County DA's office. I'm here this morning in support of Senate Bill 488. I've been an advocate for more than 20 years with the District Attorney's Office. And as an advocate that works within the criminal justice process, one of my roles is to help minimize secondary victimization. So that means minimizing the effects of victimization caused by people other than the offender. And usually that's at the hands of the systems that victims have to navigate. So the issues we're addressing today are a prime example of systems that are in place that do cause that secondary victimization when their cars are stolen. This bill addresses a significant issue that victims in our community face for which they have relatively few resources to deal with. Now, there are obviously going to be some people who have their car stolen who can navigate that process. They have the financial resources available to them, or they have insurance coverage that lets them absorb that loss. What makes this especially troubling is that it disproportionately impacts those with lower incomes and fewer resources. The difficulties that victims face when their car is stolen go beyond just mere inconvenience. It's really easy for us sometimes to take for granted how vital our car can be to earning a living and just being able to navigate your life every day. A lot of victims describe having a lot of difficulty getting to their jobs and just being able to carry out their daily responsibilities. And as you know, Oregon and Marion County have a lot of rural areas. This has a very different impact for folks who lose the ability to access their car and when that car is taken from them. So as you've heard, when a car is stolen and recovered, victims have a lot of things that they have to do to try to get that car back. Oftentimes, these are insurmountable tasks. It's not easy. It's expensive. It's very, very expensive. And sometimes it's not a very long time period before they're upside down in that car, as far as owing more to the tower than that car is actually worth, and then trying to navigate whether they can surrender that car. And sometimes they're able to do that, and sometimes they're not. So I wanted to share some of their experiences with you, and realize that these experiences are just a snapshot of what we as victim services providers hear regularly from people. But the reality is, this is a very small number of experiences that we actually hear about. As part of a DA's office, I'm going to hear from people whose cases are going through the process. So that means their offender has been arrested. And the large majority of people who are dealing with this issue, their car may have been found, but their offender hasn't been. And so they may or may not have any idea that a victim assistance program exists and can offer services for them. And so one experience that I'd like to share with you was a man who was visiting Salem, didn't live in Salem, but was visiting friends in Salem. While he was here, his car was stolen. The police recovered his car a few days later, but by the time they gave notice, it had been sitting in the tow yard for several days. And by the time he was able to actually arrange to get back to Salem, and get a ride back to Salem, his tow bill was at $1,000. And because the value of his car didn't rise to that level, he had to relinquish his car. And because he had no car, he then lost his job because he wasn't able to commute to his job and to be at his job. And that also resulted in him losing his apartment because he couldn't afford to pay the rent of his apartment, and he had to find someplace else to live. It's a pretty significant impact for someone. Another man that we worked with, it was a laborer who usually worked on the outside edges of rural Marion County. And once his car was recovered and towed, he had to take time off work, so he had to arrange and get special permission to leave work early to be able to come back into town. Once he got here to the tow company, he was told, as is part of the process, that he actually needs paperwork from the police department in order to get his car back. And so had to make the trip to the police department. And by the time that was all taken care of, the tow company was closed for the day. And so that meant that in order for him to resolve this, he had to make arrangements the second day to take time off of work, to come to Salem, and to try to retrieve his car. Not only did he have to make those arrangements for himself, but he had to convince a coworker to also leave work early, lose out on that pay, to give him a ride because he didn't have a car. And so by the time he was able to make those arrangements and to actually retrieve his car, his tow bill was $1,185. Again, a significant impact for people who often don't have those resources. And, you know, as a victim services program, we work with folks trying to problem solve around how we're going to cover those costs. A third man that I want to tell you about was actually a man who lives in Kansas, and his car was stolen in Kansas, and the offender brought his car here and left it in Woodburn in Marion County. And so as soon as he was notified, which again we know takes some time for that notification, he got on a bus, made the trip across country from Kansas to come and to retrieve his car, and had to deal with the same kinds of issues we've already described. But by the time he was able to do that and get here, his bill was already at $1,000, and he had gotten here as quickly as he possibly could. When I think about these experiences, the thing that comes to mind for me is just the word injustice. These folks haven't done anything wrong. They've actually been wronged, and yet the burden of the crime and all these collateral effects that come from it fall on their backs. And so I think that Senate Bill 488 is especially necessary, and it's a step in the right direction in trying to reduce that secondary victimization that I talked about earlier that's often imposed by the systems that we have currently present. I thank you for listening to me this morning. I'd be glad to answer any questions from you.
All right. Thank you. Meredith?
Hi. I'm also going to skip over.
Okay. Hello. Good morning, chairs, members of the committee. My name is Meredith Thomas. I'm a victim advocate with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I am assigned as a victim advocate to a majority of the stolen vehicle cases that have come into our office in the past year. For reference, we issue about 20 vehicle victimization cases per month. I am here to address the issues that I see stolen car victims face with towing companies. And it's review, I suppose, but ideally, an officer finds a stolen car and is able to get in touch with the crime victim and says, if you can come pick your car up in 20 minutes, they'll be here, and then the victim can come and pick that vehicle up directly from the officer, and a towing company isn't even involved. However, the victim doesn't answer their phone, they're not able to get there in 20 minutes, or sometimes the officer doesn't call the victim at all, directly calls the tow company, then the car is towed, which creates a problematic situation where a crime victim is entered pretty involuntarily into a relationship with a financially interested party, in this case, the towing company. And this relationship is problematic because even if the victim goes and picks their car up the next day, they're in $150 to $200 to get their vehicle out. And as we spoke about, if they cannot pay that amount, then the tower can either take their title. And most often what I've found is that even if they do transfer their title over to the tower, they have to pay a certain amount in addition of their balance that is already accrued. Or the tow yard can refuse to do a title transfer, which I've also seen happen with victims. And then their car is sitting in the tow yard while their tow balance accrues into possibly the thousands of dollars. One example that I have of a victim that I worked with, kind of a title takeover that went wrong, was a Portland State University student who got her car stolen. It was stolen for a few days. The officer called her to say that her car had already been towed. She hadn't been called before the tow company had. She arrived at the tow yard, the local Portland tow yard, and the person working there told her that her car was totaled and not drivable, and she was not going to be able to take it off the lot. She asked to see it, and they said that it was in the back of the tow yard and that they weren't able to access it, but that they could take her word for it, or take their word for it. At this point, she called her insurance company to see what she should do, was on hold for over half an hour. It was getting late in the day. The tow yard was about to close, and the employee was pressuring her to sign her title over at risk of having to pay another $200 if she was going to have to come back the next day to get her vehicle. They also looked over her policy, and the tow employee told her that her insurance didn't have theft coverage, and so she was going to have to pay it all out of pocket, and that they wouldn't cover any of her car, so it would be most financially responsible for her to sign her title over. She did that. She signed her title over at the end of that interaction, and the next day she contacted the legal aid at Portland State to talk to them about the situation because it seemed fishy that she wasn't allowed to see her car. They requested the police report and received it, and in the police report it stated that there was no external damage to the vehicle and that it was drivable at the time of recovery. She called the tow yard and confronted them about it, and they told her that she had already signed her title over, and if she would like to seek legal action, then she could, but at this point they had her vehicle and there wasn't anything that she could do about it. At this point in time, she has no car. She paid $180 to a tow company. She's been distracted from her studies for a week going to this tow company and dealing with all of this. And she, as many people in her situation do, threw her hands up and said, I'm done. I am not going to interact with this anymore. It's going to take far more time to seek legal action and try to right the situation for myself. I'm just going to leave it. And it's just an example about how subjecting victims further after, even after the initial crime, subjecting them to dealing with a financially interested party when they don't have any deal-making skills, they don't know anything about how this system works, and they're just trying to figure out how to get their car back, is pretty problematic. And this is on top of, Kim spoke about this, when somebody gets their vehicle stolen and it's recovered, nothing that was in there at the time of the theft is there still. They lose everything that was inside of their car. There's usually a huge amount of damage inherent with punching an ignition to a vehicle to get it to start with any pointy object instead of the original key. And in these cases, I mean, it just seems like there has to be a better way. To conclude, victims of car theft are not only burdened by the initial crime committed, but also the emotional and financial fallout caused by interactions with a profit-motivated business. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Before we take questions, Meredith, I do want you to kind of get me off the cliff here.
Yeah.
In the situation for the student, she threw her hands up, but somehow y'all got involved, so tell me a happy ending here.
Well, the case is still open, so I'm not exactly sure, but at this point she doesn't have a car, and we're prosecuting the person that stole her vehicle, but also the issue is that there was a lot that was missing from her vehicle, and in these unauthorized use of a vehicle cases, getting restitution ordered is really difficult because it's very hard to prove that the person that was found in the car is actually the person that caused the damage and actually the person that stole the belongings. So it's not likely that she'll see much of anything.
All right, and so there's no civil action or any way of going after the misrepresentation that occurred at the tow yard.
If she did want to pursue that through her school legal aid, if they would agree to represent her on that, which I don't even know if they would, then I assume that she could do that. But she's a full-time student. She doesn't really have time to be dealing with a lawsuit.
All right. Any questions for this panel? Senator Manning.
Real quick, I just have a question. The question is, when we're looking at when the tow company or when the police recovers a vehicle that has been stolen, I know in some instances that you alluded to, the police call and notify the victim. Do they require the tow company, if the tow company gets there, the police leave, is something like that? I'm trying to go through the bill here. Is something like that that will require the tow company to notify the victim that they have taken possession of this vehicle and where this vehicle is?
Chair Przanski, Senator Manning, yes. That in the dash ones is page 2, it's section 3, which is page 2, lines 2 through 12. To paraphrase, after a motor vehicle is recovered, the contents of the stolen report and the law enforcement data system will be shared with the tower, and the tower shall notify no later than 24 hours after recovering the motor vehicle, which is an improvement over the current system where they have to resort to DMV, and that takes days, and it's less current information. So, yes.
Okay. So since we have a little bit of time here, I'll tell my war story. In session, I can't remember what year it was. I'm going to think 2007, 2009. Pulled out of the driveway to come up here on Monday morning, looked to the out to my left where our Subaru is usually parked. Does not park there. Came back from the driveway, told Susie someone stole the car. And I'm kind of laughing because it's a Subaru and, you know, a whole lot to it. I said, you're going to have to do the report. I got to go. So she calls the police. Police takes the report. That next morning, in the wee hours of the morning, she gets a call saying, EPD, we've got your car. You have 25 minutes to get here or we're going to have it towed. Ironically, it was within 4 blocks of the house. Nothing was taken. We figured it was a joyride, and they got in there, saw we had cassette tapes, and they said, we don't want this. So everything was there, but it did put that whole thing where you had that pressure of getting to where that vehicle's at. And fortunately, she was able to walk down to get the vehicle because it was so close to it. But, you know, there are those unfortunate situations that people find themselves, and this young student that you're talking about, you know, it's, you know, I'll reserve my comments for later.
Mr. Chair, can I put one more remark on the record with your indulgence? I wanted to, as I mentioned, we convened a fairly large group, and I thank you to everyone involved, but the three gentlemen who I think will constitute the next panel, the three towers who are actually out there doing the towing, I wanted to thank them on the record. I mean, this is obviously a hard conversation for them, came to every meeting, participated, heard us out, and showed up. Yeah, we had to cancel about five times because of snow and freezing rain, and they were out there pulling cars out of ditches, which is an incredibly important social service. So I wanted to put on the record that I really appreciated their participation in this process.
Yeah, we'll do that. Thank you very much for the recognition for them. All right, y'all can step back. And then our next panel will walk the floor table. We got four chairs there. So Al, Mike, Jason, and Gary, if y'all would come up, please. And I think what I'd like to do is maybe break the testimony in the sense of y'all are signed up in opposition to 117 and the 133 was kind of open, not sure exactly where y'all are at on that. So should we combine the testimony on 117 and 133?
Yes, sir.
And then we'll do 488, and we can do it in either order. That way, y'all won't be bouncing back and forth.
Yes, sir. We can do that.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Al Elkins. I represent the Oregon Tow Truck Association. With me are today our board members, and what I'll do is just give a brief overview of where we are with 117 and 133, and then Mr. Wagner, to my immediate right, will give a overview of Senate Bill 488. And the rest can answer questions, if that's all right.
However it works, that sounds
okay.
Very
Thank
good.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Al Elkins with the Oregon Tow Truck Association. First of all, I want to thank DOJ for reaching out to us this last interim to work on these bills. We greatly appreciate the time they took with us. They listened, and Senate Bill 133 is a reflection of our work group. They asked us for a hookup definition, which is in the bill. They asked us for a towing to the nearest lost storage definition language, which is also in the bill. We are currently working with them on the bill in relation to the Dash 2 amendments, and we have some concerns, as they do as well, and we'll continue working with them on those amendments. To Senate Bill 117, we are continuing to work with DOJ on that bill to clarify some language on the amendments of the Dash 3 amendments for that bill. We also noticed that the bill has a hearing component section for hearing. We support a hearing procedure. We think that the way that's written would cause an overburden to the court system. We have an example of a model that we think the committee should look at. It's from the state of Montana. It's run by their DOJ, if you will, and it's a towing review board for resolution and complaints and resolutions. I've got five copies of this. I've taken it off the internet. We have shared this information with our DOJ. They have listened to our input on that. There were no nodding of heads in agreement. There were no, we'll get on that. It was just, they wanted the information. It was just a shallow meet and greet in terms of the information. So I'll leave that with the committee. That concludes what I have on 117 and the other. And Mike's going to go over the Senate Bill 488.
Okay.
My name is Mike Wagner. I'm from Lyons, Oregon. I run a company called Sandy M. Towing. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for taking the time to hear us. I would start off by saying that this is an incredibly difficult subject to talk about. I think that someone in our profession would have to be pretty heartless to not understand the personal loss that can be incurred when someone has their car stolen and the sense of violation that occurs there. We're not minimizing that at all. And we're grateful for Department of Justice to having reached out to us, and we've been involved in the process. We've only seen the final product for about 24 hours, so we believe there are some issues we'd love to continue to discuss with them to iron out some of the kinks. I'm assuming that's the method which that will go forward. I would like to make a few points. The first one I'd like to make is that most towing companies are small, family-run businesses. It's not a faceless large corporation that you're dealing with. For the most part, they're small family-run businesses. Seated before you, we have two second-generation business owners in the towing industry. And I 32 years ago, I purchased a business that started in 1957. So the roots of my company go back to 1957, and it's been owned by local family members, or not the same family, but it's been local family-run business during that time. The redemption rates in our industry, meaning how many cars get picked up, run between 30% and 50%. Depends on what type of vehicle you're talking about and what area of the state you're in. So what I'm saying is that if a 30% pickup rate would mean that for every 10 cars towed, three of them are picked up, seven of them remain with the tower to dispose of. The vast majority of cars not picked up in all classifications for towers are worth scrap value and have very little value other than scrap. Cherry City Metals here in Salem is currently paying $80 a ton, and the vehicle needs to be delivered to them. The further you go away from Portland, the lower the price, and cars today average about 2,500 pounds each if they're intact, if they haven't been stripped of major components. So the value of what's left in a great majority of the cases is minimal at best, and oftentimes just the act of getting it to the processor eats up the majority of what value is there. As a side note, many of the vehicles we deal with don't have current registration. There's multiple owners. That's a reflection probably of our broken DMV system, which is another discussion, but that comes to play in some of these cases also. I would note that people who have adequate insurance don't believe that the system is broken. We are dealing with the element of choice. People have chose to not cover insurance, which would take care of this. That's typically a cost issue. I'm guessing that people decide it isn't worth the value to do that. But of course, it has repercussions on the other side. I would also note that several times during the process, we have suggested that a revision of insurance requirements is possibly an option to help solve the problem. That has been immediately removed from the table during any discussion we've had. I suspect that the interests of the large insurance companies, which are typically out of state, is probably maybe they're greater than the towing industry. But society has to ask. I mean, we've made the decision nationally that health care is something that we've said people should have. The state of Oregon has said that you have to have liability insurance to drive your car. Possibly the definition of what liability insurance covers needs to be changed. And then that could be, those changes could be factored into the what it costs and would be a relatively small burden or increase for the people that are buying insurance. Government-run towing lists, which have been referred to here, rotation systems or contracts, depending on what part of the state you're in, are already struggling with the large numbers of abandoned and derelict cars, which are processed, combined with low redemption rates. In some areas, it's becoming difficult to find people to want to deal with some of these problems. The city of Portland contract would be one that you would think would be pretty lucrative, and yet there are less and less towers participating in that because the number of pay calls aren't compensating the number of non-paid calls that they're receiving. I ran some numbers on my business, and that's and I'm not done crunching those numbers, but I've got a few of the numbers. You've heard me repeatedly refer to abandoned vehicles in the same sentence. I believe that many of the abandoned vehicles that I tow are really stolen vehicles. They are stripped beyond recognition and have any identifying marks removed. My assumption is that they were stolen, and the reason that people do that is they want to make sure that they can't be traced. So a large number of our abandoned vehicles really probably are stolen vehicles, but I can't classify them that way because nobody can figure out who owns the thing. So it's just a hulk of metal. So, in my case, I have the abandoned vehicles that I tow have a 19% pickup rate, meaning 2 out of 10. the hazard vehicles that we tow, those also sometimes are stolen. Case in point, game 7 of the NBA Finals last year, I was at home happily watching the game. Got a call from Marion County Sheriff that there was a vehicle, a hazard in the middle of the road. I needed to respond. I was the only one left, so I already had guys out, so I needed to go. So I threw on my reflective shirt and hopped in my truck and ran down to meet the officer. When I got there, it was a Honda, no ID, no doors, no trunk, no motor, no transmission, no interior, in the middle of the road. And so I asked the officer, I said, "How'd this get here?" I said, "Guessing it didn't drive here." And he responded that it had been sitting alongside the road for a number of days. He believed somebody that lived nearby had thrown a chain on it and drug it out on the road so somebody would deal with it. It wasn't how I wanted to spend game 7 of the finals. I hadn't watched the rest of it. I wanted to see the last game. But it is the type of thing that we deal with as towers. And since I run a small family business, it affected me directly. And I guess my last statement is, you're asking private enterprises dominated by small family businesses to bear the brunt of losses for a social issue. I understand that somebody has to. I would also just make the statement that I don't have a tax base to support me. And the picture is not nearly as rosy as everyone thinks it is in terms of what the financial outcome is for police towing. And that would be the conclusion of my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer any. So,
all right, thank you. And gentlemen, did you want to also give testimony?
Yeah, if I could.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd like to thank you, Chair, for your conducting the meeting and everyone else for being here. My name is Jason Shaner. I'm the president of the Oregon Tow Truck Association, also owner of Rivers Edge Towing in the Columbia River Gorge, Hood River, the Dalles, Cascade Locks, and second-generation tower. And so there's a lot of things here, more so than a tower likes to compile at one time, and they all kind of bleed together. So forgive me if it's hard for me to pick what the main issue is. There's a lot. So, but I'd really want to say we appreciate, as an association, being able to be at the table, to talk to the DOJ, talk to the folks like yourselves that are making these rules. Because, again, what I'm trying to do as an industry leader here is keep it simple. Because what's hard is when you have a car. And to me, every car is the same. And you have to understand, we all feel for the people who had their car stolen. We understand. And it is a problem. It causes a lot of grief, and the system is what it is. But again, you know, from our side of it, everybody comes in, there's a problem. You know, they were arrested for drunk driving. They were this. The car was left on the highway, and they didn't think it was on the fog line. Everybody has a problem. So after a while, you tend to just, you can't hear the stories. You have to just, it's a car. This is the process. We try to keep it the same, because if you don't do that, it doesn't happen. if you say one car gets a special treatment, another one gets another, it's really difficult for the staff that sees nothing but 30 calls a day going across their desk to differentiate between the abandoned car, the stolen car, the private property impound car. They're all a car. In fact, we had this issue in a city when I was doing my planning, and when they were talking about this is an industrial use versus commercial use, and they said, well, some cars, you know, if a police orders a tow, that's an industrial use because the owner didn't have a choice, whereas the private parking or someone says it's an accident and you can move it there, now it's commercial. I don't see that. I showed them pictures. You tell me which car is which. I mean, it's a car so much of the time. And so I just want to keep it simple. And so, again, that's the main thing for everybody. There are some things that we've talked about, which like a surrender title bill, which would help reduce the amount of time we have to hold these stolen vehicles, I think is a great idea. I think that's what we do in our company. Again, if someone gets a car towed, they aren't going to pick it up. I don't want to hold it any longer than I have to. You know, generating costs, I really don't want to put them in collections for a huge amount of money that they don't want to pay or don't have the ability to pay. So again, things like that, that's a common sense, listen, this car is done, crush it, do what needs to happen as fast as possible. That lessens the burden on everyone. So if we can continue working that way to fix that issue, that's great. I think that's a good start. You know, in SB 17117, one of the main issues here is the signature on a tow. Again, patrol towing is kind of what this is aimed at, and that's, you know, the process of basically a tower or a parking lot control agent, you know, running around making sure everything is okay to tow. That's really a city issue, really, and it only happens in certain sections of the state, mainly the I-5 corridor where the parking issues are massive and difficult. As an association, again, most of our companies are small, rural. It's not a major issue. We do PPIs or private property impounds, but it's much more likely that it's a, hey, it's been parked at the apartment complex for I don't know how long. It's got flat tires. Get it out of here. Someone could be in a fire lane, stuff like that. And, you know, the biggest thing that does happen is there's also a lot of things where people park where they shouldn't park. I mean, everybody sees the lines, the lot's full, and they just pull over real quick and run somewhere. And that's fine. It happens. The biggest thing is, you know, this issue is someone calls, let's say it's in your parking spot or your lot or there's a problem. You're going to call the tow company. The tow company's going to say, we're going to show up. We're going to be on our way. 20 minutes later, the tow truck arrives. Now you have to come out on the street, sign the paper saying, yes, this car is there. At that point, you know, when people see the lights, they come running out of all the businesses, everyone's looking out the window, and now we have a confrontation with an owner of a parking spot and the towers and the person who's trying to get their car out. I've seen it before where the people are kind of, you know, who own the spot are upset. They're like, hey, this happens every day, and they kind of go off on the people, and I'm sitting there going, hey, let's all go on our way, and just, it happens. That's kind of an unintended consequence of this, but it, I don't think we really want that to happen on a regular basis. I know myself, I don't want to be in the middle of that. And so that's the only thing here. A lot of our towers who do the patrol towing, things like that, they have contracts for the lots they do. They have specific, you know, you have to look for a, you know, sign on the window that says this car is authorized parked there. Apartment complexes, things like that, that have numbered spaces are very difficult because, again, people have multiple cars. They don't have multiple stickers. People come in their spots. It's a lot of gray area, and it's not clear. Again, it's mostly a city issue or when parking lots are overly used. So that's something I think definitely needs a little bit of cleanup there. A lot of the issues, again, with the stolen vehicles, things like that, I think there's definitely room for us to work on how to solve that problem. One of the things that our association has been really looking at is the Montana tow model. And there's multiple reasons. There's lots of towing-related issues that are one-offs, bad actors, something's happening that, you know, we all want to fix, and not just the towing industry and the DOJ, but the OSP, sheriff's offices. There's multiple entities that have these same issues with small bit players in different spots. But there's no real mechanism, and there's no one who wants to, there's no easy way to fix it. The Montana model offers an option where basically there's a board such as this. You'll have maybe two representatives from towing, can be from different parts of the state, two representatives from maybe like OSP and maybe the Sheriff's Association, maybe some victim advocacy groups, consumer groups, you know, different entities, which can basically convene on these complaints so that we don't have to take up court time. We can just basically DOJ get together and hash these things out and make sure that people are following the rules that are there, set some legal precedent, which helps us actually say, hey, this is a normal good thing or this is a bad thing and it needs to stop, with actual penalties that can actually hurt the ones that we're trying to legislate against rather than just affecting a state at whole, which is, it's just a different process. So, like I said, I'm here just to answer questions and help out as much as I can.
All right. And Gary?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Gary McClellan. I'm here as the chairman of the board of the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I'm also the vice president of Ray's Towing in Eugene, and I am a second-generation tower. My father is Ray. I've been doing this most of my life, started right out of high school. These gentlemen made some really good points. I only have a couple of things, excuse me, that I would like to point out. I think that Senate Bill 117, the hearings process is too limited. I agree with the Montana model. Having a tow review board, it would solve many more problems that we have in our industry. In 113, thank you, sir. In Senate Bill 11133, I don't see in here that if we do accept the title, that we can just dispose of those minimal value vehicles immediately, as opposed to keeping them for the full 30 days. If we could just dispose of them, that would help us out tremendously. I do agree with most of 488. One question that I have, not all towers are on the Oregon Tow Truck Association as members, and you'll find most of those members are trying to do things as right as they can. The ones that we're listening to the folks describe probably are not members of our association. So my concern is with the 24-hour notice of the victim, how does our companies prove that we have done that? And then, again, if we do accept the title for that, being able to dispose of that vehicle in a timely manner would work very well for us. And thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one, again, Al Elkins, Oregon Tow Truck Association. I just want to speak to the 488-1 amendments. These are predicated on getting information immediately from law enforcement on, one, that the vehicle was stolen, and two, all the information available, which we do not get now. Some of the information that DMV has, like flags on vehicles, law enforcement would not have. So we will work with DOJ to find out how we can get it, how that information, they're asking us to respond no later than 24 hours. We need to work out what happens if it's a flagged vehicle, and if that 24-hour window is realistic for us.
All right, we're going to have a little bit more work to be done, but just for the record, Hal, or one of the guys, if you want the flag part, I know the flags are for different reasons. What would be the obstacle if the flag, you know, sometimes it could be get stolen, could be what else? What are the type of flagging that DMV does on those vehicles?
Typically, it would tell you ownership information that's not reflected on the title, which may or may not be complete. So it's very common to have vehicles, and that once you get into lower dollar vehicles, it's very, very common those vehicles are not being driven by the person that's shown on the title or the registration.
Right.
And so sometimes that information has been is there in the form of a flag, meaning that a seller notified DMV that they sold the vehicle to someone. Right. Sometimes that information says John Doe. Sometimes it says Jose. Sometimes it has a complete address. You never know.
Okay. So. All right. Other questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you all very much. And I also want to just thank you, as Aaron Knott did. I know it takes a lot of time for getting people together, but at the same time, you're what I would consider the best of your profession. Individuals who want to do the right thing and make certain the business is run correctly. I can only imagine you sitting back there and hearing the story that we just heard about the PSU student and how that makes everyone feel bad, and especially those in the profession.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. After the last hearing last year on this subject of stolen vehicles, we did attempt to get a hold of the one of the complainants, and we were not able to follow up on that. Yeah. The number that I was given was no longer in service.
So. Just give you a heads up. We will be doing some more work on these. I will be looking at addressing that PSU issue. I've got a couple of things I'm going to be looking at, but y'all will know where we might be heading.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm just going to make certain there's no one else who didn't sign up on the list who wanted to give testimony today on either Senate Bill 117, Senate Bill 133, or Senate Bill 488. Not seeing anyone running up here to give testimony, we'll go ahead and close the public hearings on all three of those bills. And colleagues, I believe that takes care of the work for today. We'll see everyone back here tomorrow morning at 8. We're adjourned. Tomorrow morning at 8. We're adjourned. We'll see everyone back here.